We've been trying to get through and to finish this study we have been on. We're in the very last section of this, but because I have been gone back and forth a couple of different times here, we haven't been able to consistently finish it. I have no plans to go anywhere over the next, whenever. So hopefully we'll be able to do this. My plan is for us, hopefully we'll be finished with this part of it by next Sunday. We have two more sections to look at in this final part that we're looking at here, and hopefully we'll be able to get through all of that. Not that we have to, but that's the plan anyway. Then we will. The plan is to start on the first Sunday in August with the next study in this is getting to know the Holy Spirit through the Old Testament. Is where we're going from this. Now, in this part of our study, we've been looking at Jesus and the prophets. We began in this particular section a few weeks ago, and just by way of real quick review as to where we have been with this, to kind of catch everybody up, we were looking at three major aspects of Jewish life that the prophets were mainly concerned with and focusing on in their work. The first one had to do with the spiritual aspect. And in there we were talking about the emphasis of the prophets had a lot to do with the Israelites and their relationship with God. It had to do with things where they were concerned with the threat of idolatry, with the problems that were related to hypocrisy and worship, and all of those kinds of aspects that generally centered around worship and their relationship with God in that respect. And one of the things that I think is a very important aspect to remember in this particular part of it is it's when we look at Elijah there on Mount Carmel challenging the Israelite people to make a choice. That's what it really comes down to, that the prophets say, you need to make a choice. Are you going to follow God or are you going to follow someone else? Are you going to follow the false gods and what have you? We see Jesus doing the same thing. In his ministry, Jesus challenged the people to make a choice. No one can serve two masters, he said. You've got to make a choice. Which one are you going to serve? So this whole idea of trying to sit on the fence and try to please, you know, different people and so on and so forth, to serve different gods and focus your attention on God is a jealous God, the Bible says. He wants us and he demands us to focus on him and to choose him. There is no other choice. And that's what the prophets presented continually. And like the prophets, Jesus was consumed by a spiritual jealousy for the honor of God. Like them, he attacked quite mercilessly those who imagined that God was impressed by religion divorced from the moral and social values of God himself. So when we look at the spiritual aspect of what the prophets focused on, we see Jesus reflecting that very same thing in his ministry. The second area that we looked at was the economic issues. The prophets focused a lot of their attention on the injustices that they saw, the social injustices that they saw amongst the Israelite people, and the way that they were treating one another, where the wealthy people were treating the poor and so forth. And if you go back to the section that we talked about concerning the law, Jesus and the law and the giving of the law, one of the things that we noticed there had to do with that when God gave the laws, he gave those laws based on, first and foremost, his relationship with the Israelite people. And that relationship was founded on the fact that God established that, and he saved the Israelite people before he gave them the law. Remember how much we talked about that whole aspect of it, that God didn't say to the Israelite people, he didn't say to Moses, here's the rules, here's the laws, get the people to obey these, and then I'll save you. Instead, he saved them first, brought them out of bondage, and then gave them the law. And the law was given based on that relationship. But inherent in that law, that God said, now here's the basis for these laws. Here's what you need to keep in mind. When you're dealing with one another, you're dealing with the poor, you're dealing with slaves, you're dealing with the with all these different aspects of social life, I want you to remember this is how you are to treat them because this is what you were. And this is how I treated you when you were in that situation. You see? And so now what we have is the prophets coming back and they're saying, okay, remember what God did. You see? You were aliens. You were slaves in Egypt and God brought you out by a mighty hand and so forth. And so when the prophets are looking at the social injustices that the Israelites are committing against one another, that raised a tremendous amount of concern and they dealt with those things. One of the primary areas of focus had to do with the land. Remember us talking about that a couple of weeks ago? The land was really the basis of their whole economic system. Okay? And when we look at the land, there's two things that we have to remember about that. Number one, that the land was God's gift to the Israelite people. Okay? And He promised that to them all the way back to Abraham, didn't He? You see? And so He gave them the land, all right, and expected them to take care of the land and to live their lives based on that gift. But the other aspect of it was that even though God had given the land to the Israelite people, the land still belonged to Him. Okay? It still belonged to Him. Leviticus 25 and verse 23, the land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine and you are but aliens and tenants. The land being the basis of the economic system with the Israelites, the laws that were given concerning the possession of the land and the transfer of the land were vitally important. And thus we come to the issue of the year of Jubilee. And we mentioned this before, the idea that, you know, every 49 years after the 49th year, whatever land had been transferred or bought or sold was to be returned to its rightful owner, that is, its original owner, the one that God had given it to. You see? So therefore, whenever land was bought or transferred, you see, the consideration for the price or the value of that land was in at least in part, how many more years do we have before the year of Jubilee where the land has to be given back? You see, if you're buying it right after the year of Jubilee, you got 49 years to possess that land, so it's going to be more valuable. The cost is going to be higher. If you only got two or three more years, then it's not going to cost as much because in those at the end of that time, it's going back to its original owner. Now, that's how God designed and intended the law to be concerning it. The problem is, and what the prophets continually dealt with and focused on, was the disregard for those laws. Where what was happening was, as we mentioned before, the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer because a person would, you know, have to sell their land because they couldn't afford to live whatever. They sell it to, you know, the rich person, they become a tenant or a slave on their own land. And the land was not being given back. It wasn't being transferred. It was being, those laws and rules were being ignored. And there were a lot of different things that had happened in disregard for those things. 1 Kings chapter 21, we mentioned the story of Naboth's vineyard as a prime example of that kind of abuse. And what we see again here, and this is an important factor in this particular part of our study, again we see Elijah there standing up on behalf of the people against Ahab and Jezebel, the leaders of the people. Jesus, we saw, began His ministry with a declaration. Go back over to Luke chapter 4, beginning in verse 16, as He reads from the scroll of Isaiah and He attaches that to Himself. And again, part of that declaration has to do with freeing the oppressed and so forth, and to bring in the year of God's favor, which is focusing on the year of Jubilee. In other words, what Jesus is saying there is that he has come to restore everything back to God's order of things. Okay? So again, we see Jesus taking up the cause of the prophets. The last part of this particular study has to do with political issues. In other words, the prophets were not only concerned about the spiritual aspect of Israelite life, they were not only concerned about the social aspect, but there was a certain political aspect of Israelite life that drew the attention of the prophets and so forth. This concerned the use and abuse of power by those who had it. Okay? And so we're looking here at those who were the leaders in the temple, for instance, you see, and how they became leaders, and those who were in the palace, the kings and so forth, the temple, the courts, all of those kinds of issues that fall under this area of the politics or the political issues. Again, what we see here concerning the prophets, Jeremiah, okay, was uncompromising in his warnings of judgment on the nation of Israel. He stood out over and over again against the whole political direction of Judah's government during its last two decades before its destruction. Jeremiah was continually challenging the king, the leadership of the people, and their position that they were taking on. Jeremiah thus was hated by the rulers because his words and his actions were politically intolerable. Not just incorrect, they were politically intolerable. And there were at least two different kings who tried to silence Jeremiah permanently because of his opposition to what they were doing. The Jews saw Jeremiah in Jesus because he did the very same things. Now, we go back to the original question that we started this section on, okay? And Jesus asked the question of his disciples, who do the people say that I am? What's the word out on the street about me? And what was the response that they gave? Some say Elijah. Some say Jeremiah, John the Baptist, or Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Elijah and Jeremiah figured very, very prominently in the people's view of Jesus because of how Jesus responded in the very same ways that they did. See? And that's most likely why the people's perception of Jesus was involving, you know, Elijah or Jeremiah, you see, because of the stand that he took. Look in John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45. Let's turn over there this morning. Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead, and now we have a situation, as people might say. Okay, we got a situation, and this is on the part of the religious leaders. This has to do with the political atmosphere at the time. Beginning in verse 45, John tells us here, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. Look at verse 48. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Now, is there not an acknowledgement in their statement that what Jesus had done was miraculous things? Absolutely. But what were they more concerned about? Yeah. You know, it's, hey, look, if we don't do something about this, then the system that we have in place is going to get messed up and destroyed. You see, the Romans are going to come because they're not going to like the rebellion and all the other stuff going on, and they're going to come and they're going to disrupt what we've already got in place here. In other words, Jesus politically was disrupting the apple cart, and they didn't like it. You see? And that's exactly what the prophets did, you see, with the Israelites in that Old Testament time. You see? They challenged the leadership politically on what they were doing. And here Jesus comes in. Of course, the political situation is a little bit different now than it was with the Israelites, okay? The crowds saw the storm, in a sense, that was brewing between Jesus and the religious authorities. Okay? You know, if you look at the atmosphere that existed when Jesus was moving about, okay? You see this constant conflict that was going on between the religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees were constantly, you know, conflicting with Jesus and challenging him and trying to trick him and all of these kind of things. Well, that's the religious leaders. Where are the everyday folks in all of this? Where are they? Well, yeah, they're in a situation where, you know, their situation with the religious leaders is not good. Okay? They are oppressed by them. Okay? So that side of things is not very inviting to them. Okay? And then you got Jesus over here on the other side. Well, he's offering some different things. He's talking about stuff like freedom from oppression, you know, sight to the blind, and, you know, has anybody ever really stood up to these religious bullies like Jesus has? You know? I kind of like this guy. But then I have to deal with the religious leaders.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I also think that if they opposed the religious leaders, they would sit down to synagogue and all of that. So, and that was a big no-no, and you ended up like at the bottom of the totem pole if this happened to you.
Yeah.
Like an outcast. So I think the everyday people just went along with it in order to, you know, remain where they were at.
Okay.
Status quo, so to speak.
All right. What are they looking for? What? Yeah. They're looking for the one who's going to free them from oppression, who's going to bring, you know, sight to the blind and take care of all that. But they're also looking for someone who's going to get rid of these Romans and restore the kingdom and sit on David's throne and have this kingdom like it was back in Solomon's day. And I don't know what in the world they're looking for. See, the reason that I want you to think about this is because we have a dilemma, don't we? That basically says this. You know, Jesus is going about amongst the people and he's teaching, he's performing miracles, and he's gathering large crowds of people that are following him. Okay? The religious leaders are jealous. Okay? You know, wait a minute here. Again, we got to do something about this guy because he's upsetting the status quo here. The people are following Jesus. The religious leaders are opposed to him and try on several occasions to kill Jesus. And then we come to the week of what is referred to as the Passion Week. Jesus enters the city of Jerusalem, how? At the beginning of that week. Yeah, as a king, riding on a donkey, and the people saying, you know, Hosanna in the highest. They're praising him as the Messiah, right? By the end of that week, what were they saying? Crucify him. Crucify him. We have no king but Caesar. Rick? Well, Herod was a lesser king. Well, Herod understood that, in that, you know, he was just the king of that region. He wasn't the king, but you see the dilemma and the situation that we have with the position of the people. Okay. All hail, King of the Jews. Crucify him. Crucify him. What we see happening, hold on one second here, Ray. What we see happening is that Jesus was constantly challenging not only the religious leaders of his day, but the people in their understanding and their practices and their traditions. He was constantly challenging them. And like Jeremiah before him, Jesus declared that Israel as a nation, and that included the everyday people, as a nation, they were on a collision course with God's judgment. Right? Well, again, you know, that's the connection that we see here between Jesus and the prophets, and why when Jesus asked that question, "Who do men say that I am?" they associated him with those prophets, because he was doing exactly the same thing that those prophets were doing, you know, all that time before them, warning the people about what was to come. And again, that main warning that Jesus gave to everyone, to the leaders and the common people, was, you know, God is going to fix all this stuff. He's going to take it all, and He's going to deal with you. See? That time is coming, and it has come. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, exactly. And when you go back to it, you look at that, you know, they had lost sight of what the Messiah was really all about. Why? Because they lost sight of what their mission was. Remember us talking about that. What was their mission? Yeah. It was to be the basic foundation and the mechanism that God would use to fulfill His promise to Abraham. Remember, we talked about that, you know, so much before. What was the basis of that promise? Through you, all nations of the earth would be blessed. They had lost sight of that was their mission. Their mission was to be the mechanism that God would use to save the world. But by the time that Jesus came along, that whole thing was completely distorted. Why? Because they felt like that God was only going to save them. You see, and they were to be separate from the rest of the world, and they were privileged and so on and so forth. So it's no wonder why their whole concept of the Messiah was totally distorted. You see, because they lost sight as a nation of what their purpose and their mission really was. Okay? When you lose sight of the mission, you see, then you lose sight of how to get where you're supposed to be. And that's what was happening to them. Okay, let me get Pat and then Judy over here. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just like as Ray was saying here, their whole concept was it's all earthly. You see, they lost sight of what the mission was. You see? Completely. Judy?
Well, you know, and then when you look back at the apostles, they have kind of missed it.
Oh, yeah.
Either until, you know, in a dream, God let down the sheet with the different things. And
oh, yeah.
Can't do this because it's unclean. And then the light bulb went on.
Right.
Now I understand that God is no respecter.
Right, exactly.
And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, it took a little while. Again, as we've mentioned so many times before, you know, 3.5 years with Jesus, the disciples stand there on the mount and say to Jesus just before he returns to heaven, Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom? You see, they still didn't understand because they had not really captured and held on to what the mission and the purpose of Israel was all about. Brian? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. And that's why we have all this unrest that we have going on over in that part of the world because of all this. You know, they misunderstand the whole thing, and so do the Muslims, you see, and the Arabs over there. There's a complete misunderstanding of what that's all about. Rick?
Pat had asked me, are you Jesus answered? Yes, I am. I'm not. This they could not think about everything.
Yeah. And so since Jesus denounced a worldly kingdom and that wasn't what the Israelites were looking for, what reason would they have to continue to support him? You see? Judy?
Well, that's kind of like when Rick mentioned, you know, that he was asked if he was a king. He is the Jews and the Jewish leaders so concerned what Rome would do if they let him continue in the ministry. But if you look at it, Rome wasn't all that interested in him. You know, so it just goes right back to him. They really denied what the real problem was.
Right.
It's us, you know, and the power we are holding.
Exactly. Okay, let's take a look at, and I don't know if we may finish this all up today. I don't know. We'll see. When we look at Jesus' words and actions, we're looking at three basic aspects here that Jesus focuses a lot of teaching, a lot of energy on. And these words and actions illustrate the importance of the prophetic aspect of Jesus. Okay, and the first one has to do with the Romans. Okay, as we've been talking about, you know, their Roman situation here and everything. When you look at Jesus' position on the Romans, what was it? Yeah. Yeah. What we find is that instead of Jesus preaching this violent revolution against the Romans, which is what the people wanted, you see, Jesus taught love toward the occupiers, didn't he? Rick? Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, remember when we talked earlier about the makeup of these disciples that he had, you know, and here's Simon the Zealot in there. You know, he wanted to go after these guys, and he's ready to jump on board with Jesus because, you know, okay, Jesus is the guy that's going to get rid of the Romans. And yet here is Simon, you know, yeah, he's probably listening to Jesus going, boy, I tied my tether to the wrong ship here, you know. You know, when Jesus says, for instance, in Matthew chapter 5, verses 40 through 45, if someone forces you to go with him 1 mile, go with him 2. Well, what does that have to do with anything?
Well, I think any Roman soldier would take a subjective person and say, here, carry this load, you know, whether it's my shield and I'm tired or
yeah,
something I'm taking.
My pack or whatever.
Yeah, carry it. Go a mile.
Yeah.
After that, they had to let you go back to about your
right.
Place.
Exactly.
Christ is saying, you know, after that first mile's done, say, you know what, buddy? I'll walk with you another mile.
Yeah.
It'll be nice.
Oh yeah. And
said that there was a stone in every
yeah.
Jewish house. Each correction.
A mile.
Inch,
right.
50 inch of 1 mile.
How this is how far I have to go.
They thought about the law. They know that the law of infinity. So exactly.
Here it is. Right. And now Jesus is saying, I want you to ignore that marker. I want you to volunteer to go a mile beyond that for these people that you hate. How do you suppose that settled on the ears of these folks? When Jesus said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You mean I'm supposed to pray for these Romans, these dirty Gentiles, these oppressors? No. You see, that went against everything that the Jews had hoped for in a Messiah, didn't it? He's supposed to be getting rid of the Romans, and now he's telling us we need to love them, we need to serve them, we need to go the extra mile for them. What kind of a Messiah is this?
It kind of makes me wonder how much it blew the apostles' mind. You know, you're supposed to go there and teach them about what these speeches are and get them to check them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to accept them in here.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of the...
Oh, yeah. Talk about upsetting the apple cart. Okay. The second area had to do with the Pharisees. So it wasn't only the Romans to deal with, but it was also the Pharisees. And Jesus confronted them, that is the Pharisees, the religious leaders, over their concept of holiness. You see, they, that is the Pharisees, the religious leaders, sought relief from Roman oppression by means of holiness so that God would intervene and free them himself rather than through armed insurrection. The Pharisees were nonviolent kind of folks. Okay, now the Zealots, that's another whole, you know, they're ready to take up arms. But the Pharisees, their whole issue had to basically centered around the idea and the concept of being holy. If we can be holy enough, then God will come. Because we're so holy, God will have to come and save us. And God will deal with these Romans, and He'll get rid of them, and He'll free us from their oppression, and we won't have to fight any battles or anything like that. So the means to get rid of the Romans was through our own holiness. And thus, as we've talked about many times before, the whole concept of all the traditions and the laws and the fences that they put up, those were a means by which to gain holiness, so that God would turn His favor toward them and He would take care of their problems. Now, certainly then, the Messiah would never defile Himself by associating with publicans, with sinners, and prostitutes like Jesus did. So He could not be the true Messiah. If the means to restoring the kingdom was through holiness, Jesus didn't match and meet up to the concept of the Pharisees' holiness. And that's why, again, we see these confrontations and these conflicts. You see, when Jesus was at the home of the Pharisee having dinner, and the woman came and she's anointing Jesus and she's washing His feet with her hair and her tears and so forth, and Simon is over there thinking, if this man knew what kind of woman she was. See, that had to do with holiness. There's no way that this man, if he were truly the Messiah, would allow himself to be touched by this kind of a sinful, unholy woman, because that would make him unholy. And Jesus then challenges him on his whole concept of holiness and forgiveness, doesn't he? You see? But you see where these conflicts arise. In their view, in their concept of what the Messiah was and what God was going to do and what Jesus was actually doing. Ray? Yes.
He wasn't for those who were open from the mouth of the higher echelon.
Right.
He
was for the common folk.
Common folk.
Right. Okay. Well, the third area here, the final section on this, has to do with the temple. It's not only the Romans, it's not only the Pharisees, but it also was the temple. Okay? Jesus' words and actions, you see, had a lot to do with the confrontations concerning the issues around the temple and the way that the people felt about the temple. Jesus threatened, Mark chapter 15, verse 29, to destroy the temple. The people remembered that. Remember when He was hanging on the cross. You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it, take yourself down off of that cross. They remembered what Jesus had said, though He never threatened to destroy the temple. You see, that wasn't what he said. He was talking about Himself. You see, when in the mind of the average Jew, and not just the Jewish leaders, but the common folks, that was one of the most scandalous things that Jesus ever did, was threaten the very temple itself. How could they truly trust in a holy Messiah who would threaten the very existence of the temple? See, that was part of their issue with him. They saw the temple as the place where they could truly be Israelites. Of all the places that existed for them, the temple was their true identity as Israelites. It was the place where God was. And it was their connection to Him. It was their temple. There was no other place on earth like it. And Jesus, in their mind and heart, threatened to destroy it. The temple had become for the Israelites a symbol of Israel, listen to this, of Israel at odds with the rest of the world, rather than an Israel for the nations. That's what it had become. They found their identity in the temple. And that identity separated them from the rest of the world. Rather than for them to see it for what God intended for them to be, as we said, their purpose was to be the light for the rest of the world, they saw it as their unique possession that separated them from the rest of the world. In Mark chapter 11 and verse 17, Jesus, when he drove the folks out of the temple, said, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." See, we oftentimes forget that part of Jesus' statement. See, we focus on the "my house will be called a house of prayer." But Jesus said, "for all nations." And that did not set well with them. Instead of being a fortress to keep Israel safe and the nations out, the temple should have been a beacon of Israel as God's light to the nations. That's what it was intended to be. Jesus saw in the near future not an act of judgment by God on the Gentiles, which would finally exclude them entirely from the temple, Jerusalem, and the land, but rather an act of God's judgment on the temple itself as the center of such exclusiveness and the beginning of a new extension of blessing and salvation to the nations. This was a thorough and politically intolerable reversal of the temple ideology of Jesus' day.
Well, don't you think they also kind of limited God on where he
could
be?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, God's only in the temple.
Absolutely.
You know, God is among us at all times. I kind of thought about this a lot of times when I read that. It was kind of, all right, you just put God in the temple and that's where he's going
to
stay.
Yeah, well, again, it that comes back to that whole concept of the physical versus the spiritual, that we take God who is spiritual and we confine him to a physical place, you see, and thus losing sight of the whole spirituality of it, you see. So the consequences of Jesus and that question that Jesus asked of his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" You see, we see in the prophets and Jesus' connection to them and the way that he challenged the people in the same way, we saw the inevitable conclusion was going to be crucify him. Crucify him. We have no king but Caesar. Okay, we're finished. I hope that this study has been enlightening to you, helping you to get perhaps a little bit better of a concept and get to know Jesus a little bit better and a little bit perhaps different from looking at the Old Testament and seeing Jesus through the eyes of the Old Testament and how Jesus saw and used the Old Testament in his ministry. We're going to start next week. So we finish this all up. We're going to start next week looking at and trying again the same thing to get a better understanding of the Holy Spirit through the Old Testament. All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.